A Song Came After, written by Susie Carter, read by Silvercat 1620. Summary. It requires every ounce of will he can bring to bear to force himself to meet Clark's eyes. Clark looks shocked. The expression is undiluted by anger or dismay, though perhaps he simply hasn't had time to grasp what just happened. His eyes are wide, round, and impossibly blue. Color is rising into his cheeks. His mouth is half open, slack, with the slightest damp shine where... That was... Bruce makes himself stay and then stops. Christ, what word can he use? What adjective is there to acknowledge his trespass fully? Inappropriate. Inadequate, but it's the best he can do, and Clark needs to hear something. Needs to know Bruce recognizes his own mistake for what it is. I apologize. Notes. This is, very belatedly, the story I wrote for the world's finest zine. I am so incredibly grateful to all the pandas in the world, who is on AO3 and Tumblr, for very kindly inviting me to contribute to it, and also for upping the word limit, given that I probably couldn't have stuck to the original maximum to save my life. Thanks you all, my fellow contributors, for making the zine happen and for doing such a fantastically lovely work. And I also owe a special thank you to Free Sketch Go, also on Tumblr and AO3, for sending me the ask that gave me the seed of this idea, well before the zine was ever a thing. I told you I would probably write at least half a dozen more variations on this premise, and I wasn't kidding. But here's the first one, at least. Heart. Dr. Bedlam is technically from the comics. He's part of Darkseid's group of bad guys on Apocalypse and specializes in mental manipulation. And that's pretty much everything you need to know about him to understand what's going on here. I am through with singing, I said, and I shook my head. My heart broke, I said, I am through with laughter. A song came after. From Life by Adela Purnell. The silence is, briefly, absolute. The cold rush of awareness is both mental and physical, a surge of prickling adrenaline. On its heels comes slow, sinking self-comprehension. Bruce opens his eyes. He isn't faced with anything he couldn't have predicted if he'd taken 2 goddamn seconds to think. The table, specifically the dark, glossy wood of the main meeting table, around which Diana, Arthur, Victor, and Barry are seated, and no doubt all 4 staring at him. The mug he just set down, chipped and familiar, one of the first pieces of Superman merchandise sold following Black Zero. Tea still steaming gently. His own mug of coffee in his other hand. And Clark. It requires every ounce of will he can bring to bear to force himself to meet Clark's eyes. Clark looks shocked. The expression is undiluted by anger or dismay, though perhaps he simply hasn't had time to grasp what just happened. His eyes are wide, round, impossibly blue. Color is rising into his cheeks. His mouth is half open, slack, with the slightest damp shine where... That was, Bruce makes himself say, and then stops. Christ, what word can he use? What adjective is there to acknowledge his trespass fully? Inappropriate. Inadequate, but it's the best he can do. And Clark needs to hear something. Needs to know Bruce recognizes his own mistake for what it is. I apologize. Bruce, Clark says, hushed. Bruce should stay. He should allow Clark a moment to gather himself, to accept Bruce's apology as he inevitably will. Clark hasn't managed to hold the murder attempt against Bruce. The odds are in Bruce's favor here, however little he deserves it. It would be best to let it play out and then go ahead with the meeting, minimize the impact of his error by treating it as minimal. But he can't. He can't. He sets his own mug down on the table, hands steady, and then he turns around and leaves. It doesn't take Clark long to find him. He hadn't expected it to, though he'd entertained some hope that the League would go ahead and hold the meeting without him, that his stay of execution might be extended a little. Clark is considerate, as always. He doesn't ambush Bruce, doesn't sweep in at Mach 2. He must come through the house. His footsteps are audible along the full length of the dock. When he reaches Bruce, he sinks to his knees. He's still holding his tea in one hand, and with the other he reaches out to set down Bruce's coffee. Christ. Clark, Bruce says and picks it up. Bruce, Clark says, cautious. He clears his throat. I know you probably don't want to talk about this. His tone says he's aware his words are constitute a staggering understatement. And something about that, the open, sheepish self-deprecation in his voice, makes it possible for Bruce to flick him a wry glance instead of fixing his gaze on the surface of the lake the way he'd planned. Clark offers him a quirked half-smile, there and gone, and then looks at Bruce with, of all things, concern. But you don't make mistakes, he says. Not like that, anyway. You make mistakes when you're doing things on purpose for the wrong reasons. You have too much self-control to... He stops and clears his throat again. His ears are red. To kiss me just because you couldn't stop yourself, or... You're right, Bruce says, rather than force him to stumble onwards. Besides, it's true. Clark's too generous, unsurprisingly, but his essential point is accurate. Bruce would never have kissed Clark, and certainly not like that, in the hall, in front of everyone with such unthinking ease, because he wanted to. Bruce had told himself that when Clark came to him, he'd tell the truth. He'd volunteer it, commit it to bearing it utterly, because Clark couldn't be counted on to pry it from him. Both better and worse that it turns out Clark knows him well enough to see the shape of it already, even if he hasn't, can't have, figured out the rest. But Bruce can, at least, surrender what remains. That's the minimum Clark deserves. Bruce had the opportunity to avoid having to explain this, and squandered it. He has no one to blame but himself. He sips his coffee, still hot. He wonders distantly whether Clark poured it fresh in the lake house kitchen, or just knows the exact number of picoseconds he needs to direct the laser vision at a piece of ceramic to heat it without damaging it. And then he looks out across the lake and says, 6 weeks ago. When you were trapped in that machine, Clark says. As if he had any reason to remember it as distinctly as Bruce does, when it must have been an ordinary afternoon's worth of peril for him, a matter of hours between discovering Bruce had vanished and locating the ship in orbit, the apocalyptic scientist who'd taken him. But Clark looks troubled when Bruce meets his eyes. We didn't know what it was doing to you. That alien, Bedlam, whatever he was calling himself, he said it was a simulator, that he was establishing a baseline for observation before the real work started. But he wouldn't tell us what that meant. He wouldn't tell us how to get you out of it. He stops, throat working and looking away, rubbing a hand over his face. Victor made it let you go, he says more evenly. And you said you were fine. You said you didn't remember anything. I lied, Bruce says. Clark's gaze snaps back to him. Bruce, he says slowly. Because he is, perhaps, remembering why he followed Bruce out here in the first place. He is, perhaps, starting to wonder why what happened 6 weeks ago explains anything about this morning. Bedlam was a scientist, Bruce says. He wanted to study me. He wanted to understand how I could have been responsible for Steppenwolf's death, who I was, how I'd brought the League together, how I could be capable of things Apocalypse and Seers were claiming I would do. He pauses. A baseline for operation, he repeats, and is seized by the peculiar, pointless urge to laugh. He can't make himself look up. He can't figure out how to. The clerk's weight shifts, the motion transferred by the dock, and a warm, steadying hand comes around his shoulder, thumb soothing against a hesitant arc before Clark says, "Bruce," again, cautiously, carefully. "I remember everything," Bruce says, watching his own hand tighten around his mug, focusing his attention on the task of modulating his grip. "I assume he would have run me through a variety of scenarios in order to assess my behavior, analyze me, see whether he could discern a pattern and render me predictable if you hadn't interrupted him. As it was, he completed only one simulation." "One?" 30 years, Bruce makes himself say. 32 years, 5 months, 17 days. But Clark doesn't need to know that. He bites down on the inside of his cheek, hard. He has to convey the essential facts. He has to clarify enough of this to explain himself. Beyond that, the details are irrelevant. "I experienced 30 years. Contiguous. Without interruption. As if I'd lived them normally. I..." The warmth of the mug in his hand. The smooth glaze. The wooden dock underneath him. The sunlight. The water. He reminds himself of each of these things. And breathes. "Formed habits," he says. "Habits," Clark repeats. And then the penny drops, as Bruce had known it must. "Habits like..." He grinds to a halt. Bruce doesn't, can't look at him, but hears the click of his throat as he swallows. "Like bringing me tea." "And yes," Bruce says. "Because," Clark says, "in there we were..." "Yes," Bruce says. He doesn't know which term Clark intended to use. Together, married, in love. But all of those options are accurate, so it doesn't matter. Bruce's answer wouldn't have changed. And hearing any of those words, spoken to him in Clark's soft, astonished voice, would be significantly more than he can bear. He knows his limits, and for all the iron-fisted control he's exerting over himself, he's treading very near those limits. This conversation has come to a reasonable close within the next 2 minutes. Otherwise, there will be no way for him to keep the worst of this massive fucking mess from spilling out where Clark can see it. And that's unacceptable. "As I said, I apologize," he tells the lake steadily. "I believed I'd reoriented myself well enough to avoid making that kind of mistake. And I was wrong. I should have explained this to you earlier, and I didn't. I should have warned you that I might act inappropriately toward you, and I didn't." Clark is quiet for a moment, but he hasn't moved away, hasn't lifted his hand off Bruce's shoulders. Knowing Clark, it's deliberate, a conscious effort to avoid withdrawing in a way Clark himself would consider unkind. Even if yanking his hand away and leaving would be entirely understandable under the circumstances. And then Clark says, "It's fine, Bruce." Bruce couldn't have met his eyes intentionally. It's involuntary to cut a dubious glance sideways. And Clark clocks it and smiles, the barest quirk of one corner of his mouth. Not precisely amused as such. Deliberate, just like his hand on Bruce's shoulder, an extension of kindness, undeserved. "It's fine," Clark says again more firmly. "It was," and his cheeks go pink again, his mouth pressing itself into a line before he clears his throat but gets it out. "It was a kiss. That's all. It's fine." He shifts, slides his hand across Bruce's back, giving himself room, Bruce understands an instant later, to bump his shoulder gently against Bruce's. "It isn't like you tried to kill me again. It's okay." "Christ. Lucky I set the bar so low," Bruce murmurs, wry, and takes another sip of coffee. It's necessary cover, the release of tension, the relief of Clark's forgiveness was suddenly enough that his hands started shaking too much to compensate for. Clark laughs, half a breath through his nose, and shakes his head. The smile is still there and a little bigger now, a little more real. Yeah, he allows. And then he looks at Bruce and bites his lip, and something about his face changes, grave and searching. What was it like? He isn't asking for Bruce's subjective impressions, for a soliloquy on what it felt like to be married to him for 30 years. He can't be. There wouldn't be any point in it. He's curious, Bruce decides distantly. He wants to understand what? Why the simulation went the way that it did? Except that must be obvious. Something else, then. How it worked, perhaps. It felt, Bruce says, and then stops. Telling. So fucking telling. But he can do no better. It felt real while it was happening. Disengaging from it was confusing. An understatement. He'd spent almost 2 days convinced he'd experienced some kind of temporal displacement instead. Once I understood what had happened, I logged everything I could remember. But nothing in the past 6 weeks suggests the machine was extrapolating in a way that can be used to predict the future. Strategically, he adds rapidly, because Christ, it isn't as if he's been watching Clark, expecting Clark to... If there are signs of any conflicts in the League faced in the simulation that are reoccurring, I'll run a proper analysis. Of course he will, Clark says quietly. And then, for an instant, he looks strange, tired, withdrawn, resigned. But then he meets Bruce's eyes and his mouth slants. Well, it's fine, Bruce. I promise. We're okay? He holds up his mug of tea, eyebrows raised, a gentle invitation. And Bruce lifts his coffee, touches the edge of his mug to Clark's with a ceramic click. Clark won't demand recompense from him, won't punish him. The least he can do is make amends, then, is give Clark what little he does ask for. At first, Bruce dares to think that's all. That even if his own thoughtless error had required him to expose the truth to Clark, he's navigated the aftermath without making it any worse. He doesn't make the same mistake again. Clark doesn't bring it up, but isn't avoiding him either. Is, if anything, painstakingly careful not to. The rest of the League appears to be taking their cues from Clark, as if they've all tacitly agreed to treat it as forgotten. Or perhaps not so tacitly, if Clark spoke to them about it. But Bruce is disinclined to try to imagine what he might have said to them, how he might have explained it to them, and for once feels no urge whatsoever to find out. The League isn't going to pry. Clark clearly has no interest in dwelling on it, and Bruce is, to the best of his admittedly questionable ability, dedicated to avoiding any further errors. It's over and done with, and that's for the best. Or at least it seems that way, for a time. It's been nearly a month when the League comes up against a series of mythological creatures, summoned by a sorceress hunting for a way to reach the mascara. Just one more of the various dangers they found themselves facing, or it would have been, if Clark hadn't been turned to stone. It doesn't kill him. The Medusa's gaze reaches him in midair, but Diana catches him before he can hit the ground. Within 6 hours, they've located an enchanted spring whose waters can reverse it. The process isn't instantaneous. Diana's lasso speeds it up, but not much. The first 90 minutes are the worst. Clark turns back, starting at the head. It's subjectively torturous to Bruce, monitoring his hair, strand by strand, trying to calculate how long it'll take. And then, much more objectively so, as the changes reach Clark's face and two things become clear. that the sensation of feeling his body shift from stone to flesh is undeniably painful. And then until the change reaches his chest, his lungs, he'll be lying there awake, aware, with his heart unable to beat, his body unable to breathe. It won't kill him any more than being turned to stone had, but his expression tells Bruce unmistakably that he finds it excruciating, and without air, he can't talk either. Bruce tries to reassure him. Clark can't feel the pressure of a hand against his stone arm. It's inexorable necessity that leads Bruce to offer him the paltry comfort of clumsy fingers in his hair instead. Bruce tells him everything they know, everything they've found out, and Clark watches him, silent, intent. His eyes seem fiercely blue, his face shockingly expressive for having so recently been rendered in pure marble, pale and immobile. Color, living warmth, creeps so fucking slowly down the line of his throat. Bruce keeps catching himself staring, willing that smudged line to move faster, and then jerking his eyes up to meet Clark's again. Just a little longer, he tells Clark over and over, pointless and inane. And then, at last, he presses his free hand to Clark's chest, half the fabric of Clark's uniform, warm and forgiving, and half stone, and feels a thump. Once, and then again, and that must be at least half Clark's lung capacity returned to him if the curse is driven down as far as Clark's heart at last. Bruce, Clark gasps. He still can't move his arms or hands. Diana's lasso is looped around his torso, glowing gently gold. Bruce touches his hair one more time, and then forces himself to be reasonable, to grip him by the shoulder instead. Clark, he says, it's all right. It's all right, you'll be fine. Tell me what I can do for you. Tell me what you want. He sees Clark's eyes widen, his mouth twisting, and only then understands his own misstep. But it's too late to take it back. The lasso gleams brighter as Clark blurts out, I want to know if anything like this happened in the life you remember. Yet again, the error is Bruce's. He shouldn't have made such a demand, not without imposing boundaries of some kind with the lasso here. And worse still, the lasso means the question must be real, means that of all Clark might have chosen under these circumstances, that answer is the thing he wants most from Bruce. It's as true now as it was that morning at the lake. The least Bruce can do is give Clark what little he asks for. Yes, he says aloud, striving for a quiet, even tone, even as the act of telling Clark this will cost him nothing. Several times. More often me, he allows, and is rewarded with a breathless half-laugh. But sometimes you. Kryptonite, usually. Once it had been rendered into a liquid solution, you'd been injected with it. Flushing it from your system took hours. It had affected you so strongly, we couldn't afford to cause any additional strain to your body. You hated it, Clark says softly. I hated it, Bruce agrees. He bites his mouth, but it's the truth. It's only the truth. Clark asked him for it, and he can hardly justify refusing to give it. I couldn't do anything for you, but I wouldn't leave. It's excruciating to say it. His face feels idiotically hot. He's doing precisely the same thing right now, and there's no way Clark can fail to realize it. It's agonizingly obvious, a visceral and telling exposure of a fact he'd hoped to avoid confronting Clark with more than once. He clears his throat. By the second day, I was irritating you. You teased me for making such a nuisance of myself. Made me stop monitoring you and just sit with you instead. We kissed. But Christ, he can't say that. He stops. Clark had been listening, gaze in the middle distance. When Bruce falls silent, he meets Bruce's eyes again, and it's clear it doesn't matter what Bruce can or cannot say. Clark isn't stupid, and he's more than capable of inferring what may have come next. But he doesn't make a face, betrays no discomfort or displeasure. His expression is sober, his mouth pressed into a soft, sad line. "Oh," he says very quietly. He swallows. "Thank you for telling me," he adds, and then closes his eyes. A dismissal, if Bruce chooses to take it as one. Except Bruce has, if anything, just explained to Clark very clearly that if he wants Bruce to leave him alone, he'll have to say so. Clark doesn't say anything, and Bruce doesn't go. In short order, it's clear that the question wasn't a fluke, but rather the first crack in the dam. Because after that, Clark keeps asking. There's never any warning. Clark had already developed a certain habit of showing up in the cave while Bruce was working on some piece of equipment or other, or at the monitor room in the hall during Bruce's final daily security checks. Small mercies. It's also never when anyone else is around. Always when it's late, quiet, when they're alone. And then, over and over, Clark asks, wanting to know something Bruce remembers, wanting to know what it was like. Did we live together? Did we have a dog? Did people know about us? Bruce tells himself it must be odd for Clark. It must be strange, knowing that Bruce had lived out so many years with such a fundamentally distorted copy of him, acting out all of Bruce's most mundane desires. It isn't as if it's deliberate. It isn't as if he intends to subject Bruce to such a specific and inimitable torture, requiring Bruce to describe it to him. He's curious, that's all. And Bruce has, as ever, no right to refuse him. So, yes, Bruce says, we had our pick of Wayne Realty properties, but I suppose the hall was the one that was ours. Yes, Bruce says. Someone left a puppy on the side of the road to the estate. You heard her whimpering in the middle of the night. You said you'd take her to the Humane Society first thing in the morning, but by breakfast you'd named her Nellie, and you were teaching her to sit. Yes, Bruce says. And Christ, he'd hoped to avoid this, but one glance at Clark's face says that it isn't going to be enough. Yes, we were married. He forces out, by the skin of his teeth, restrains himself from tacking on an apology, as if it will mean anything in the face of the evidence. That he wants such a thing, and badly enough to have warped Dr. Bedlam's simulation into giving it to him. Clark echoes. We were, You asked whether we lived together, Bruce reminds him without looking up. We did. Bruce Wayne couldn't plausibly choose to move into Clark Kent's apartment. I apologized for that. You laughed. You told me I was being ridiculous, as if you weren't going to have the time of your life innocently country bumpkining your way through Bruce Wayne's public narrative. You meant it. Loved it. It was fun to you. It didn't wear on you. You never got sick of all the lying. You never got tired of me. I told you I would have moved into your apartment if I could have, and you looked at me like... You kissed me. You touched me all the time. You loved me. He wants to shout it, wants to throw it in Clark's face, wants to plead his case. It was possible once, on the inside of some goddamn apocalyptic machine, and it could be possible again, couldn't it? Couldn't it? But he shuts his eyes and swallows it down and waits, grimly, numbly, for Clark to ask again. And that's how it goes for a while, until the day Clark asks a question Bruce isn't expecting at all. It takes a moment for Bruce to even parse it, to understand the words in and of themselves. When he does, he still can't make sense of them, and there's no help for it. He looks up. What? What was he like? Clark repeats. He's seated on the edge of the work table, close but not touching, nearby but easily able to avoid Bruce's gaze, which he's doing, looking past Bruce with his mouth pressed into a line. The, me, he clarifies. It's impossible to figure out how to answer. Surely he can't honestly be asking Bruce to describe in every last mortifying detail how he sees Clark, how he perceives Clark, how he must have subconsciously decided Clark would act if Clark felt the way Bruce wants him to feel in order for the simulation to have played out. Bruce is paralyzed by that impossibility more than long enough for Clark to notice it. Clark's weight shifts just a little and he clears his throat. I get it. I do. He must have been different, done something different, something right. You wanted him, so he argued with you less. Clark, Bruce says slowly. Or he was less stubborn, Clark says. Guesses, Bruce understands dimly, a stab in the dark. He listened to you? He didn't make mistakes. Clark, Bruce says again, more sharply, more firmly. Christ, how can Clark have possibly misunderstood? The value of Dr. Bedlam's simulation depended on my inability to tell it was a simulation. It was drawing on my mind, my understanding of the personalities of the people I knew, my impressions. It must have been. It needed to be congruent with those impressions in order to avoid making me suspicious. And he stops and bites down on the inside of his cheek, grips the edge of the work table to hide the shaking of his hands, and brings his tone under control. And in point of fact, it may well have been designed to do the opposite, to deliberately give me reasons to want to think it was real. Clark is staring at him. It must be clear to him now. I should have known something was wrong the first time you kissed me back, Bruce grits out anyway, because he has to. Because that was the true mistake and always has been. I should have known, but I chose to believe otherwise. For a moment, Clark's expression doesn't change. He's wide-eyed, slack-mouthed, shocked. And then his brows draw together slowly, and he wets his lips. Bruce, you don't know that. Clark, Bruce begins. You don't know how the simulation worked, Clark says over him more loudly. You can't. That machine was a pile of slag when Victor was done with it. You've got no idea what Bedlam was using to program it. For all you know, he took some kind of a psychic imprint of each of us that morning. He didn't need it to be congruent with your impressions. He needed it to be accurate if it was going to fool you for 30 years at a time, over and over again. No, Bruce says, because no, that makes no sense. It's far too implausible. It would mean, it would... Something passes across Clark's face, leaves it settled in determined lines. He turns, on the table, thigh at a diagonal that presses his knee to Bruce's hip, and leans forward, reaches out and touches Bruce's cheek. Bruce, he says quietly, unevenly, and his fingertips skim down the line of Bruce's jaw, ask with gentle pressure for Bruce to tilt his chin. And Bruce has never been able to justify refusing to give Clark what he asks for. Clark kisses him, presses his mouth to Bruce's, shyly, and then more firmly, sweet and soft, undemanding. And then he catches his breath and murmurs, Bruce, I didn't know. I thought I was different, that I'd done something different in there, and I was never going to know what it was. No, Bruce hears himself say. No, it was just you. It was... that you let me, that I was allowed to. Clark draws a sharp breath. Jesus, Bruce. Okay, it's... I am. I'll let you. You are. You're allowed. It's impossible. It must be impossible. But then he turns his face into Bruce's, kisses Bruce's jaw, cheek, and then his mouth again. And it's true. It's real somehow. It's real. And Bruce closes his eyes, holds on, and kisses back. The end.